This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon is preparing for a presidential election Sunday despite security challenges in three parts of the Central African state. Thousands of polling stations in Cameroon's restive English-speaking regions and the Boko Haram-prone north have been relocated. After 36 years of President Paul Biya, many voters are skeptical about whether their vote even counts.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzika. We'll have the latest on Cameroon coming up. Also, U.S. First Lady Melania Trump is in Kenya, the third stop on her Goodwill Africa tour. The 2017 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to a doctor from the DRC. And some Western countries express concern over South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. U.S. First Lady Melania Trump today visited two Kenyan orphanages, one for children, one for elephants, on her week-long tour of Africa. Mrs. Trump stopped by the elephant orphanage on a visit to Nairobi National Park, a few kilometers south of the Kenyan capital. She fed a baby elephant using a giant bottle and got a small bump from another baby eager for its feeding. Afterward, Trump visited a Nairobi children's home known as The Nest, which cares mainly for children whose parents are incarcerated. Trump earlier visited Ghana and Malawi on her first visit to Africa. This also is her first extended solo international trip as First Lady. She next heads to Egypt, the last stop on a tour that has focused on child welfare, education, tourism, and conservation. Trump's visit includes promoting the work of the U.S. Agency for International Development. President Donald Trump twice has proposed slashing the agency's budget, but Congress has not approved those requests. Well, in Nairobi, Ruben Chama talks to Kenyans for their thoughts on U.S. First Lady Melania Trump's visit.
With the U.S. First Lady Melania Trump visiting Kenya as part of our four-nation tour of Africa, Kenyans are expressing their views about the high-profile visit. Hilda Njeri is a Bachelor of Commerce student from the University of Nairobi.
I think it has come at the right time where she should come and maybe talk about her campaign, Be Best, which deals with issues to do with youth, particularly youth and drug abuse, cyberbullying, particularly the drug opioid. So I think she should focus on the youth, especially in Kenya, maybe try to advise people against the use of drugs.
Another student, Joan Kiarie, says Mrs. Trump's visit will help spotlight issues that affect children in Africa.
I think she can be able to shed a light on some African issues that have not been able to reach the part of America before. Although she's not exactly a strong international figure, we're hoping she will at least bring some help to the country.
Kiarie says lack of access to education, especially among the poorest and among girls, should be given top priority.
You should target areas which do not receive education, the children who are still getting married at a young age, or the children who are told to work instead of go to school and study, or like how there's an issue where girls, instead of going to school when they are facing, when they're having their menstrual period, instead of going to school, they stay at home. Or where boys, instead of going to school, they're told to stay at home and look after the cows. I think she should focus on education in Africa mostly.
Others like Olenyo Okello have a different opinion.
Her visiting us will be an eye-opener. She could at least go back and share these views with the president. We have that potential to grow as a society. She could also help encourage our youth, the ladies and the young girls we have in societies, that they can really make something good out of this, of themselves, since she has a background in modeling.
Through a campaign called Be Best, which she launched earlier this year, Mrs. Trump has focused on issues touching on child welfare, drug abuse, and cyberbullying. Anzense Were, a renowned Kenyan development economist, agrees those issues are of great concern.
I think drug abuse is an issue that's growing in concern. I think because of the exposure that particularly the young Kenyans have to international media and the types of drugs that are becoming increasingly available in the country. So I think that's relevant. I think cyberbullying is also important, particularly for young people who are active online. There have been cases where people have been bullied online and sort of the negative fallout from that. In terms of the priority of things, it may not be up there, but it's definitely stuff that young people grapple with.
Mrs. Trump arrived in Kenya late Thursday from Malawi for a series of public events on Friday before leaving for Egypt, our final stop. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The 2017 Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to Denis Mukwege, a gynecologist in the DRC, and to Nadia Murad, a Yazidi human rights activist and survivor of sexual slavery by Islamic State in Iraq. The Norwegian Nobel Committee said that Mukwege, who founded the Pansy Hospital, is the most unifying symbol of the struggle to end sexual violence in war. Mukwege has called on churches to speak out against sexual abuse and condemned the inhumanity that some men show toward women. He said the world must draw a red line against sexual violence. He also has criticized what he calls the unbearable atrocities being committed in eastern DRC by armed groups. His co-winner, Nadia Murad, was a captive of the Islamic State group. The prize committee says she refused to accept the social codes that require women to remain silent and ashamed of the abuses they suffer. Murad and Mukwege will share the Nobel's gold medal, a diploma, and a check for about $1 million. Cameroon is preparing for a presidential election on Sunday. Despite security challenges in three parts of the Central African state, thousands of polling stations in the rest of English-speaking regions and the Boko Haram-prone north have been relocated. But as Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé, after 36 years of President Paul Biya, many voters are skeptical about whether their vote even counts.
Cameroon's Minister of Agriculture, Henry Eyebe Ayisi, pleads in the Ewondo language for people to cast their vote on Sunday's presidential election. President Paul Biya sent Ayisi to campaign for him in Monatele, a town near Cameroon's capital city, where he spoke to a crowd. Among the audience is Mercy Nkwenti, a teacher who escaped violence in her town Bamenda, capital of the English-speaking Northwest. She says on her way to Yaoundé, armed men ambushed their bus and seized her voter card.
What they said is, why are you guys voting? You already know the winner. Why should you waste time to vote? Then they took it.
Quentin says she does not know if the armed men were separatists who have vowed to disrupt the presidential election. Despite the threats, she would still vote if allowed because Cameroon, she says, needs a change of leadership. Not all Cameroonians are as keen on the election as Nkwenti. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics says there are 13 million potential voters in Cameroon, but only half the population has bothered to register to vote. 37-year-old electrician Emmanuel Nga refused to register because he has no confidence in the elections management body. Nga notes cynically that all the election officials are appointed by President Biya, who is himself a candidate and at 36 years in office, one of Africa's longest ruling leaders.
My one problem is I don't have a voter's card. And even I had, there's no need for me to vote because nothing will change the way I see. We don't know if we're going in front or behind.
In Cameroon's troubled English-speaking regions, where separatists are fighting for an independent state, few are expected to vote. And election observers are reluctant to visit the areas of unrest, which could put the legitimacy of the vote into question. Felix Monono is an election observer with the Center for Research on Governance.
Those separatists even issued an embargo that there should be no movement. If you are caught, they may kill you, they may kidnap you. And then secondly, the security who are there, they are also a big threat because they are like trying to control movement. And then at times, they are also very hostile to people around. So we are not very sure what can happen.
Along its northern border with Nigeria, Cameroonian authorities moved more than 10 polling stations to locations safe from Boko Haram. Despite no major violence in the past year, authorities fear the Islamist militant group could be provoked by Sunday's election. 8 presidential candidates are challenging Biya, who is seeking a fresh 7-year mandate. But faced with a divided opposition, Biya is widely expected to win. His main opponents include Joshua Osi of the main opposition Social Democratic Front and Akere Muna, a veteran lawyer and former vice president of Transparency International. The Ministry of Justice's Maurice Kamto is leading the Movement for Cameroon's Renaissance, MRC party, to the polls. Cabral Libi is an eloquent 38-year-old journalist and candidate for the Universe Party. Other candidates include Garga Haman Aje of the Alliance for Democracy and Development and Adamu Ndamjoya of the Cameroon Democratic Union. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United States, Britain, and Norway released a joint statement last month expressing concerns about South Sudan's revitalized peace agreement. Ambassador Chris Trott is the UK special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. He recently told VOA's John Tanza that South Sudanese leaders have no choice but to implement the commitments made in the September 12th peace deal.
Our concern has been all the way through the negotiation process, the sincerity with which the parties are addressing the conflict. And what we're particularly keen to see is demonstrations from the parties now that they are going to live up to the commitments that they have made. And in particular, our focus has been on the cessation of hostilities agreement that was signed last December. Our feeling is that there has been ample opportunity for the parties, through adherence to the cessation of hostilities agreement, that hostilities agreement, to demonstrate that they're going to really address the crisis seriously. And we've continually called on the parties to stop the fighting, to allow humanitarian access, to give the space to civil society and to the media that was guaranteed in that agreement in December. And as yet, we've not seen that agreement fully implemented. And so if that agreement's not been fully implemented, our concern is, will this new agreement be fully implemented?
Yeah, your role, among other things, is to address internal conflicts and encouraging sustainable development in Sudan and South Sudan. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So what we've sought to do is to try and build bridges between the different parties. We're conscious of the fact that when there is a conflict going on in a country, it's very hard for dialogue to start. And what we've always wanted to do, particularly in the context of South Sudan, but actually it applies also in Sudan, is to ensure that the dialogue about the future of the country is an exclusive one in which people are able to genuinely express their desires about what the country should look like in 5, 10, 15 years' time. And my role as an envoy has been to try and help facilitate that, working in the Sudanese case to the AU High-Level Implementation Panel, which is still playing a role in trying to bring peace to Sudan, and in the context of South Sudan, to be working with IGAD and the IGAD negotiation or mediation team to try and take this forward.
And the South Sudan government, especially some senior officials from the government, let's take a case of the spokesperson of the government of South Sudan, that is Information Minister Michael Makui, was on record last week asking the international community to support the government to implement the revitalized peace agreement. What is your response to this appeal?
I am absolutely committed to supporting the implementation of a peace agreement, of the peace agreement. I think that what we need to do is to ensure that we support not just the government, but all the parties, including civil society, in the implementation of this agreement. And actually, this is why I'm here in the United States right now, is to talk to the US government. I'm here with my Norwegian counterpart, and we're talking about how the international community can work together to ensure that this time the agreement is implemented in the way that it has been designed to do. Because unfortunately, in 2015, the agreement was very good, but it was never implemented. And we want to try and ensure that this time the things are different.
And you listened to the Deputy Director for Policy at Enough Project, who was saying that, look, things in South Sudan are just done the same way over and over again. There's nothing new. There's the issue of transparency and accountability. Is the international community keen on that?
Absolutely. We're very keen on that. And we've made it very clear in our conversations about the current peace agreement. The way that we make this agreement sustainable is by ensuring that there is transparency around the agreement, transparency around the way in which a transitional government operates, transparency around the spending of the revenue of the government of South Sudan, which needs to be in support of the ordinary people of South Sudan. And therefore, you know, we're looking for a partnership that helps bring about that transparency.
That's Ambassador Chris Trott, Britain's Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. He was speaking to my colleague, John Tanza. The International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, says more than 40% of conflicts worldwide involve 3 to 10 parties. Many of them have loose command structures, making it harder for humanitarian groups to identify leaders and allow the delivery of emergency relief. Today, the ICRC is using a new approach for identifying group leaders and encouraging them and their fighters to curb violence against civilians and to respect international humanitarian law. From Washington, William Eagle has the story.
A study by the ICRC looks at ways that humanitarian organizations can curb violence and encourage cooperation among a range of armed groups, from centralized state militaries and ideologically driven groups to those with fragmented leadership influenced by local values. The more centralized groups tend to be well-trained and disciplined, with rules and values established in doctrine and enforced by top commanders. These include national militaries and ideologically disciplined groups that are not supported by government resources and infrastructure. Among them are the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq and past African liberation movements. The study found that military in some countries were more likely to be influenced by instructors with combat experience as well as knowledge of international humanitarian law, or IHL. It also found that group values, such as warrior's honor, tend to discourage soldiers from acts of violence against civilians, including rape and other abuses. Dr. Fiona Terry is the head of the ICRC's Center for Operational Research and Experience in Geneva.
The norms of restraint really need to be socialized much more into the military. It's got to go beyond just the socialization in you can't do this, it's against the law. Respect for the law gains a lot more traction if you're able to make it about the identity of the soldier. It's not what I do. I don't do it because it's against the law. I don't do it. I don't violate IHL because it's not who I am.
The ICRC says a different approach is needed for armed groups with loose or fragmented leadership. Many smaller groups have little, if any, formal training in curbing violence and protecting human rights. Some are made up of local fighters who are embedded in the community and are mobilized only temporarily. That is the case in parts of South Sudan, where the ICRC studied cattle herders and pastoralists among the Dinka and Nuer. Humanitarians found that some norms of restraint were transmitted by culture, like cattle camps, where young men learned to raise livestock. Others were influenced by prophets and spirits. Fiona Terry explains.
In the Nuer tribe, there is the sort of the Nuer spirit is the bad blood. And if you commit atrocities, then you are pretty much damned. But you could perhaps in the past have had prophets reinstating the good blood. But it seems that for many of these fighters, it's gone too far almost, and they sort of have abandoned the idea that they are redeemable, and therefore the violence has spiraled.
Terry says it's not clear if this or other customs could be revived in an effort to encourage restraint, or if traditions could be used to introduce concepts of international humanitarian law. In one example, an ICRC first aid trainer and local men compared the law of war with rules for traditional wrestling.
Once he'd heard the explanation, would then play a bit dumb and sort of say, well, hang on a sec, I don't really understand. So you like to wrestle, but could you challenge that woman over there to this wrestling match? And of course the guy thinks, oh my God, how stupid, she's far too weak and she would never be a match for me. And what about that child over there? No, no, the same thing, you know, derisive laughter bursts forth. And then on that basis, being able to open up and to start discussing, well, it's the same thing in warfare. You also, you know, don't challenge people who are not the same capacity of you. They are not worthy to meet you.
The ICRC study provides its project leaders with a simple blueprint to help identify the differences in discipline, leadership, and values between formal armed groups and those with looser or local leadership. It says identifying and negotiating with those who influence combatants can make it easier for humanitarian groups to deliver relief and staunch violence against civilians. Red Cross officials say that idea couldn't be more timely. They say more armed groups have emerged in the last 7 years than in the last 7 decades. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. First Lady Melania Trump goes to Africa. J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and Jennifer Cook, director of the Institute for African Studies at the George Washington University, talk about the First Lady's trip to Ghana, Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt, as well as the latest on U.S.-Sudanese relations. That's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday, on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.